Welcome to Meet the Masters of Income Property Investing. I am your host, Jason Hartman.
The 2019 Meet the Masters of Income Property, March 23rd and 24th in Newport Beach, California.
What is the sort of the one trick, the hack, the secret that really empowers people to success? Income property, the most historically proven asset class in the entire world.
Register today at jasonhartman.com/masters. Early bird pricing ends Friday, February 1st.
Let's break this down and look at some of the strengths of income property as an asset class.
I found that this event is really helpful because I'm totally a newbie to real estate investment, and so I picked up so much information.
One of the great things about it is that it's so fragmented, right? Embrace the fragmentation.
jasonhartman.com/masters.
This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to The Commercial Investing Show, where we analyze, explain, and exploit the opportunities presented in today's commercial property marketplace. If you're interested in apartments, mobile home parks, self-storage facilities, and other income property, you've come to the right place. We'll explore what's hot and what's not in markets nationwide in the relentless pursuit of return on investment. Here's your host, Jason Hartman.
It's my pleasure to welcome Matt Taibbi. He is contributing editor for Rolling Stone and winner of the 2008 National Magazine Award for columns and commentary. He's a New York Times bestselling author of Griftopia, Bubble Machines, Vampire Squids, and The Long Con That Is Breaking America. Also the author of The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap, and the new book, Hate Inc., How and Why the Press Makes Us Hate One Another. Matt, welcome. How are you?
Thanks very much. I'm doing very well, Jason.
Good to have you on the show. You're coming to us from New Jersey, is that correct?
I am from Jersey City.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, when did you do the article in Rolling Stones about the bubble machines? That was quite a few years back, wasn't it?
It was. It was right after the 2008 election. I had never covered the financial services industry before, and I had been mostly a campaign reporter. Mm-hmm. And after the economy collapsed, they assigned me to do a story about AIG and why AIG collapsed. And we got such a response from doing what essentially was sort of a translation for ordinary people about how Wall Street worked,
right,
that I ended up doing it for 8 years. So the next story after that was about Goldman, and that was the bubble machines one.
I remember that article, Matt, and it was a rather famous article, as I recall, and I have talked about it many times on my show over the years. It's just great to have you on the show because now this is going back from memory, but you know, you talked about Goldman Sachs a lot and how they create these bubbles, and then when the bubble deflates, they profit. They profit on both sides of the bubble, which is pretty brilliant, but I hate it at the same time. You know, I always, I call Wall Street the modern version of organized crime.
So, yeah, a lot of people say that. It's like only the last names are different.
Right.
You know, they don't have the Italian last names, but there are some similarities for sure.
There's no question about it. Well, explain to us how that works, how the bubble machine works, how the bubbles are inflated, you know, in the cycle of easy credit and expansion, and then they pop. They always do. You know, back over 100 years ago when the Federal Reserve was created, ostensibly one of their mission statements was to prevent these extreme cycles in the marketplace and in the economy and to, you know, end the bubbles. But they haven't done that at all.
No, and I think you can probably trace the modern patterns of bubbles to Fed policy. I mean, a lot of people look back at the late 80s and they look at what happened with the crash in 87 as a precursor to what happened in both the 90s tech bubble and then the subprime mortgage bubble afterwards, because, you know, essentially what happened was the street got wiped out in 87, and then the Fed, you know, rather than let all that pain kind of have a corrective impact on the economy. They completely loosened interest rates. And, you know, the analogy I kept hearing was everybody drank themselves sober. They were allowed to sort of quickly recapitalize, reinflate, move into the next scam, you know, which turned into whatever it was, junk bonds or tech stocks. There's a continuous cycle of inviting people to come in until the market can no longer bear it. There's a rush for the exits. The individual traders cash out, but everybody else gets killed. And that's what happened on a smaller scale leading into the subprime thing, which dwarfed all the rest of them.
Yeah, it sure did. Okay, so, and feel free to be as simplistic or in-depth and sophisticated as you like, but how do they create the bubbles? And when we say they, it's sort of all of them, right? It's Goldman Sachs, it's the Federal Reserve, it's, you know, the Treasury. Everybody has a hand in it, obviously. But there are certain powers that are just incredibly powerful when it comes to the ability to play God and create bubbles and then intentionally burst the bubbles, right? Take us through that, kind of the chronology of how that works, if you would.
The core idea is you're trying to invite everybody to put as much money as they can into this sort of investment bubble. In the case of the subprime crash, one of the things that happened was they found a way to use derivatives to pool and package subprime mortgages in a way that allowed them to take junk-rated mortgages and sell them as AAA-rated securities. So,
and when you're saying they, in this part of the conversation, you're talking about Goldman Sachs mostly, right?
Yeah, it's investment banks for the most part. Right. So you, most people out there, they might be familiar with a lender like Countrywide or Long Beach or, you know, one of those companies. You probably heard from them. They probably knocked on your door and offered you a refi or a mortgage. And they got everybody to sign on the dotted line, and they got, you know, gazillions of these loans. And the reason they were able to do that is because there was a huge market for people buying these securities because they were able to use a process that sort of mismarked the securities, right? They were actually not worth a lot because a lot of the people who were buying these loans were, they didn't have jobs, they couldn't afford the house, they, you know, weren't even citizens in many cases, but there was no due diligence. And so people were buying tons and tons and tons. They were investing in what they thought was American real estate. Right. So this massive, massive speculative bubble in real estate happened.
So wait a sec. So you mean when people were investing in what they thought was American real estate, they were buying the securities that allowed all that money to flow into the mortgage market, right? Is that what you mean when you say that?
Exactly. Okay. And typically these weren't individuals that were doing this. Right. These were typically institutional investors. So usually they were going after pension funds or hedge funds or insurance companies. So, it, you know, the way this worked is kind of strange. You know, you'd get a representative of a big investment bank and they would take out some state official who makes $81,000 a year representing the state's employee pension fund.
Like, and like CalPERS would be an example. Well, that wouldn't be state, but it's the teachers. Well, that is sort of state, I guess. But it's the teachers' retirement fund in California, the big one. They're huge, obviously.
Yeah, they're huge. They have tons and tons of money. And that's what they do. They go after these whale funds.
Right, right.
And they take out this official and, you know, they'll take him to the Super Bowl or a strip club or whatever is.
And they'll wine them and dine them.
They'll say, hey, why don't you buy $2 billion worth of this stuff? And the presentation they'll give is great. You know, it'll cost less than a comparably priced security or a comparable real estate security, but it'll have excellent returns. And people bought tons of this stuff. Right. But it turned out that the actual mortgages inside the package were really dubious. And that's why a lot of people woke up in 2009 and found that their retirement fund had lost 40% of its value. So it was a pretty devious scam when you get right down to it.
Sure, no question about it. So that's when everybody's 401k became a 201k, as they say, right?
Right.
So they would wine and dine one of these officials who made the investment decisions for these retirement plans. You know, the person making $81,000 a year, you got the bankers that are making millions every year, taking them to strip clubs, the Super Bowl, doing the whole thing. And, you know, of course they made the decision, hey, we should invest with you. You know, one of the funny things I've always found in life is that, you know, the crooks in the world of business are always the most generous people, you know, and they always buy off all these people around them. They like, they overpay their employees, they overpay their vendors, and everybody loves them because they're dealing with stolen money, basically, yeah, no, right? It's pretty easy when it's not your money, you know?
And these people were, they were expert. One thing they're able to do is sell, you know? Mm-hmm, I mean, sure. If you talk to people on Wall Street, you'll find yourself saying, wow, that's a great investment. Like in 2 seconds, they're able to get you mentally into that space. So The ability to identify somebody who's the gatekeeper for a huge pile of money somewhere and get that person to fork over with them. I mean, that's what this was all about.
Yeah, right. Okay, so this is the run-up cycle in the bubble, right? This is when the bubble's being created. They're getting people to invest in these dubious assets, or even many times in that example, assets that don't even exist in the first place.
Right.
When they've taken the same loan, the same mortgage, the same piece of paper, and sold that piece of paper into 33 different pools. So it's literally not even there. It's not just the quality of the loan being subprime, you know, letting the janitor that's making 50 grand a year buy a $900,000 house. It's not just that. You know, it's a duplication. It's a cloning of assets where the assets are just vapor. They're not even there, right?
Yeah, no. And sometimes it was even worse than that. You'd have the synthetic credit default collateralized debt obligation, right?
Which the CDO, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So you essentially what you have is you have like a, think of it as a taco that has a whole bunch of other tacos in it, right? But inside the individual tacos are just bets on other mortgages. It's really hard to contextualize all this stuff, but essentially what they were doing, they ran out of real people to lend to. Mm-hmm. So they started creating credit default swaps that were pegged to existing loans, and then they would make a package out of that and sell that as a security. So what you were investing in wasn't even a real mortgage. You were investing in the sort of mirrored revenue flow of somebody else's mortgages, which is crazy, you know, and that's how all these sort of artificial losses appeared out of nowhere.
Yeah, you know, this is the derivative scam, and I call derivatives the thing about the thing, right? And the amazing thing is, it's not just the thing about the thing. It's a thing about the 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 thing. You know, it's 39 levels deep until you get to something real. And by the time you get to something real, as you peel back that onion, you know, the real asset is worth nothing compared to the value of all those derivatives that have been sold that are pegged to the real asset, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And the structures of those vehicles can be so complicated that even the people at the ratings agencies can have a hard time sorting it out, right? Like they'll have a hard time actually tracing where the original asset is or who owes what or what the risks are. I mean, that was the huge problem with all of this.
Yeah, it certainly is. Okay, look, we've all spent a lot of time in the last 10 years talking about the Great Recession. Okay, so maybe we can just kind of shift gears and let's go to the broader kind of macro view about the bubble machine, okay? And just look at the big, maybe a longer period of history, because the Great Recession is fascinating how it all happened. It was terrible, obviously. But what sort of happened over the decades, if you will, you know, create the bubble and then offload the assets to other people. And then, you know, the assets will crash, right? It's like a
hot potato game, yeah.
A hot potato game, a musical chairs game, you know, either one. And then you buy those assets back on sale after the crash, right? What about that side of the cycle?
Yep.
Tell us about that.
You can also bet against the instrument on its way down, which was another thing that happened a lot.
Oh, yeah. You know, you see all these different interviews with these various congressmen where they're interviewing one of these financial execs. I mean, they've all been on the hot seat. You know, you were selling your customers one thing and then betting against your own customers at the same time.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't make this stuff up, folks. It's unbelievable. It's disgusting.
No, it was genius in a way. Yeah. I mean, you know, and some of them, Goldman was probably the best example because they were the bank that realized the earliest that they had to get out of the subprime game. And there's an extraordinary, because of the Senate investigation, there's an extraordinary record of all these emails, you know, where they're saying things like, we've got to sell all these cats and dogs. And what they would do is they would sort of go around the world looking for suckers that they could unload this stuff to. And meanwhile, you know, they're creating bets against their own product.
Everybody listening, if they haven't seen it already, should definitely see the movie Margin Call. Matt, I'm sure you've seen it, right?
Yeah, definitely. A very good movie.
That was an excellent movie. How do they buy the assets back? Talk to us about the entire cycle. You know, and everybody listening, think of this like you're looking at a graph, right? And you're looking at this graph on one axis is time, on the other axis is value. And the graph has this run up, and you see the hill sort of running up like a hill or a mountain, maybe a hockey stick even. And then it goes to the top, and then it crashes after that, and you see it on the way down. And there are peaks and there are troughs, peaks and valleys. What happens on the other side?
This all becomes about the access to capital, right? So, you know, everybody knows if they wait out the market long enough that these big bubbles are going to inflate, burst, and then once everybody rushes for the exits, there's going to be a whole bunch of distressed assets, which you can then go in and buy, provided you have the capital to do it. And that's why the access to Fed largesse becomes so important. In all of these cycles, whether it was 87, whether it was 2001, or 2008, when they had to go to extraordinary measures with the quantitative easing, all of these banks were able to borrow massive sums from the public treasury. Well, not the treasury, from the Fed.
Right.
And essentially go out and get themselves well again by buying up all this stuff that was now worth fractions of what it once had been.
Right. So herein lies the reason that the old saying exists, right? We've all heard the old saying, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, right? Because the rich have access to capital that they can basically borrow from the Federal Reserve when nobody else has access to capital, right? And so that's when, you know, the reason bubbles occur is because credit or money supply, one or the other, they're in many ways the same thing, but not exactly, it expands and contracts, right? And the amount of assets in the marketplace expands and contracts. So they can do what J. Paul Getty talked about, buy when everybody's selling and sell when everybody's buying. They're on whatever side of that cycle they want to be on, or maybe both sides of the cycle at the same time, aren't they?
Right. Yeah, exactly. The name of the game is, you know, as long as there's activity and they're taking out fees as they go,
they're making money on the trade either way.
They're making money on the trade either way. It doesn't matter as long as there's a lot of activity. And you know, with all of these different cycles, whether it was SNLs, whether it was tech stocks, whether it was, you know, emerging market currencies or the subprime mortgages, it didn't matter. As long as they had people flowing into the market and then flowing out, they were able to make fortunes just on the pure heat of the market. So they're always incentivized just to get people coming in.
That's sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. Why do you call Goldman Sachs the vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity? I love that, by the way.
Yeah. Rolling Stone has this thing they call wisdoms, where they felt like sometimes if we just do too much exposition and there's not enough explanation, they say, hey, you need to add a wisdom there. I had been writing this piece and I just wanted an image of something that was ubiquitous and kind of stuck to everything. Mm-hmm. So I came up with that, and it's so weird. It's turned into this huge thing. Like, you know, there are marches in Europe and they have these huge papier-mâché squids. And right. Like, I hear the EU has investigations into banking corruption. They call vampire squid meetings.
Yeah, that's great.
It was all over Occupy. So it's been really weird. In fact, I hear the Goldman people even think it's funny. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, well, they're profiting it from it. So I guess they can have a little fun with it, right? So how are investment bankers auctioning off America's infrastructure?
Oh, well, that's another really interesting question. I found out about this because I had a friend who worked for the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, which is like a sovereign wealth fund in the Middle East. And he had been at a pitch meeting where somebody was trying to sell the group that he worked for. They were trying to sell the Pennsylvania Turnpike. And it turns out that all over the country, what you have are a lot of sort of cash-strapped public entities. And what they're doing is they're selling the revenue-generating public entities that they have. And it could be parking meters. It could be garages at airports.
Toll road. A lot of toll
road. Exactly. Yeah. There was one in one of those in Indiana.
Red light cameras, speeding cameras. All of these, yeah. All of these represent revenue streams to municipalities, right? Because the government has gone into business against the citizens, sadly. It's not about safety or law enforcement anymore. It's about revenue, revenue, revenue. And so now these revenue streams have become very valuable. So a city, a municipality, can sell off its revenue stream for all of its parking meters. And guess what the motivation is now? To make more parking violations, to make parking right. more restrictive, to make it more difficult to park, to find a place to park, to give out more drunk driving fines and arrests, to give out more red light camera tickets. All of these things are revenue, revenue, revenue. And, you know, if you're a municipality that needs cash, you're going to look for every way you can to get revenue. And the worst places where the government has gone into business against the citizens in the worst ways are the most cash-strapped places. So you look at California, my former home state. You know, I've heard stories of people getting speeding tickets in California that are insane. You know, $700-$800 speeding tickets. Crazy numbers on these tickets. My mother was driving my car once at LAX to drop me off at the airport. And in many states, they don't require a front license plate. Well, I didn't have a front license plate on my car. And so the ticket turned out, after it, you know, was late being paid, to be $600 for not having a front license plate on a car. I mean, can you believe it? It's insanity.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's totally gouging. And
that should have been, if they cared about the law, that would have been a $10 fix-it ticket.
You know, right.
That's what it would have been. Yeah. That's what it used to be when I was a kid, that type of thing. Right. But now everywhere you can get revenue, you're going to get it. And they sell those revenue streams to Wall Street. Right. So now it's just big business. You know, the business is fining people as much as you can. Right.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, part of that is because politicians don't want to take the political hit of raising taxes. Right. So
they can raise them in these subtle ways that only affect mostly the poor. You know,
right.
I mean, rich people, you know, they might be upset that they get a $600 fine, but it's not going to change their life. Someone living paycheck to paycheck, that could put them out on the streets, you know?
Yeah, and you have no idea where that fine's going to come. You could end up at the DMV and paying $300 fine for a registration fine. Or in California, for a long time, they were imposing huge draconian fines for being caught driving without a license, like way over $1,000. And the idea there partly was about raising revenue, but it was also aimed at undocumented immigrants. The concept basically is we're not going to just raise taxes because that's going to be too unpopular. So let's find every other place that's that we can, where we can squeeze you for something, and that'll be our way out.
So here's the thing, folks. The next time you see one of your city's finest, you know, the officer dressed in blue, who may be a very well-intended, wonderful officer that could save your life someday, remember, that person has also now been deputized as a tax collector. Okay,
that's right.
So that's the way it is, sadly. It really is. And then we didn't even bother to mention the prison industrial complex, did we? Because that's a huge profit-making enterprise too. But, you know, write a book on that and we'll do a show on it in the future, Matt.
Sure.
Yeah, Wall Street's in that game too. You know, look, the vast majority of our listeners are real estate investors. And what real estate's all about is high occupancy and getting as much rent as possible. Well, what could be more profitable than running a prison? and you can up
especially
your occupancy,
yeah,
just by making more draconian laws. That's all you need to do. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely disgusting. Well, what is the lesson from the bubble machine? I mean, look, it's interesting. Everybody listening is interested. It's an interesting topic. We all know, you know, Wall Street is the modern version of organized crime. But what is the lesson for the typical middle or upper middle class investor? What should they do with that information? If you have any thoughts about that, maybe you don't. Maybe it's just a, you know, sort of an academic thought experiment to understand this stuff. But is there any like practical, actionable advice?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I came into this completely as a novice, and my main takeaway is that a lot of what's happened in what we call the financialization era of Wall Street, right? Because you used to make money through the traditional way of they would lend businesses money to build factories or do repairs or whatever it was.
That was all good. The idea of raising capital, capital formation is what creates lots of progress. We all love that. But that mission has been sidelined, hasn't it?
Right. Yeah. And that's really what the sort of junk bond revolution was all about in the 80s. It was the realization that they could generate capital so quickly and so instantly that they were now, you could now make more money just through pure paper transactions than you could by investing and waiting for later returns, right? Yeah. So a lot of what Wall Street does now is they're really essentially asset stripping schemes. You know, whether if you take, for instance, the example of subprime mortgages, well, I think what they really did is they looked out over the landscape and they said, where's most of the money in this country? Well, most of it's in people's houses. And so how are we going to monetize that? And let's find a way. And they, you know, they did. They got lots and lots of people into loans. They resold those loans. They moved a lot of paper around. I think for ordinary people that it's a caution, like don't get caught up in these sort of quick fixes that promise you short-term returns that turns out to be false gold for a lot of people. And from my own experience, I've become a lot more conservative about how I deal with money since I've had to cover this.
I couldn't agree more. You know, all anybody really needs to do is follow a few basic principles. If you've been wooed and lost a fortune in the cryptocurrency game or precious metals or Wall Street, especially a non-dividend paying stock. I define an investment, it's really a simple definition in my mind. Here's what an investment is. It's something that has a real asset that produces real income. Period. That's right. That's an investment. Anything else is a speculation. It's just gambling. Investing is the legitimate process of creating value over time. And your capital can create value by doing something real in the world. That's why I like real estate so much, and I like the direct ownership of real estate, because it's a real thing. You know, it's sticks and bricks. It provides housing to people who need it. And, you know, you're not going to hit a home run in a month or a year. But, hey, you wait 5-7 years and you're going to be surprised at how rich you'll be.
I totally agree with you. I think that's the way to go. And you know, just be wary, right? You know, like, you know exactly what you're getting into.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Good stuff. Matt, really interesting conversation. Give out your website. Tell people where they can find your books and so forth.
Yeah, you can find me at taibbi.substack.com or at www.rollingstone.com.
Spell your last name for the listeners.
It's T-A-I-B-B-I.
T-A-I-B-B-I. Matt, thank you so much for joining us, and we really appreciate having you on the show.
All right, thanks a lot, Jason. Take care.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.